The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your home for serious content amidst an unserious culture. Welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. Today we have back with us once again, Jason Purcell. As you remember, Jason was with us talking about the petrodollar system. And we're going to go more into depth on that. Last time, if you haven't listened, go back and listen to that episode. We'll provide links for you in the show notes. And we kind of went through the history of essentially what, Jason, the 1930s through the early 70s on the theory of the petrodollar. And now we want to dive in, you know, more on the evidence and the lack thereof, perhaps, of the petrodollar system. And you can explain all that jazz.
Yeah.
Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds good. I thought we could go ahead and just start with a one paragraph representation of I think something that completely wraps up the idea of the petrodollar system
Sure. Pretty
well. And so it's just an excerpt from, you know, it's usually described pretty much the same way. There's not a ton of variation. So this is just an excerpt from a Forbes article that came out earlier this year. And the title of that Forbes article was, it was called A Spate of Oil Dealings with Foreign Countries Undermines the Petrodollar. And I didn't actually write the title down, so that's a little
It's too long of a title.
Yeah.
I want to talk to the editors at Forbes.
Yeah, agreed. So it says the petrodollar was more formally established as the global currency of marque for oil trades in 1973 in the wake of the first Arab oil embargo. Then the Nixon administration executed an agreement with the Saudi Arabian Prince Fahd ibn Abdelaziz, in which the Saudi kingdom agreed to conduct its oil trades in U.S. dollars in exchange for U.S. military support and hardware. The establishment of this agreement between what at the time were the largest buyer of crude oil, which was the U.S., and the biggest exporter of the product, Saudi Arabia, created a paradigm that other importing and exporting nations quickly began to follow. A strong majority of international oil trades have traditionally been conducted in U.S. currency, i.e. the petrodollar. And then there's a Mises Institute article that goes so far as to say that the Saudis, it references the same agreement. Actually, no, it doesn't. It references an agreement in 1974, but there's a Mises Institute article that essentially says the same thing, and I'm not picking on the Mises Institute or anything. They did great work. It's just a contributor, you know, wrote about this.
Sure.
And it says that since 1971, with the closing of the gold window, it goes so far as to say that the Saudis started demanding gold and other fiat currencies to pay for oil, rather than being satisfied with dollars.
Uh-huh.
And then in order to counteract that, this petrodollar agreement was made so that, you know, the Saudis would only take dollars for oil, and in exchange, the U.S. would provide protection. And that kept the U.S. from going into what you might call a currency failure or a hyperinflation.
Okay.
So instead of being tied to gold, we tied to oil, and there you go. We're off to the races. 50 years later, the U.S. dollar is still global reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
Any opening thoughts on that? Well, or
so their argument is that we do have a so-called petrodollar.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just given as a fact that our U.S. dollar is now backed by Saudi Arabian oil, or mm-hmm. oil in general, I guess. You are here to say not so fast, as Lee Corso might say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you're correct. And the reason that I started going down this track in the first place is because when this war broke out in 2022, actually it really broke out in 2014, Russia and Ukraine.
Okay.
But that's when this conversation really started to hit the scene again, because who's a major exporter of oil and who's been satisfied to take dollars for oil and euros for oil in the past? Well, that would be Russia. And Russia has friends, the Brazil, India, China, and South Africa.
Non-OPEC, non-OPEC oil producing nations.
Right. Yeah. Well, the BRICS are not unified in the fact that they, Russia is a member of OPEC Plus. So okay. What ties the BRICS together is I would say they're manufacturing and commodity strong. Okay. Russia and Brazil are two members of BRICS who are what I would call long oil, which means they have it and they process it. And that's one of their key industries. Whereas the others, you know, China is definitely short oil. It harms China when oil is expensive. It harms India when oil is expensive, harms South Africa. I believe I might have to double check that one. But but the big players in BRICS, you know, China and India, which are two behemoth economies, are definitely harmed when oil is expensive. They're not in the extraction business.
And so not that you didn't mention this, and I don't know if it has anything to do, but the one country that isn't mentioned outside of OPEC and these other nations you mentioned, Nigeria, do they fit in there somewhere? Because they're the only other big oil producing nation, but they're not a really strong nation as like these other ones, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nigeria is a member of, I don't remember if they're part of OPEC, but they're definitely part of OPEC Plus.
Okay.
So when they report on, you know, production increases and cuts and everything, Nigeria is included in that pile. Yeah, they're definitely a producer. You know, Libya is another one, but because the Obama administration turned Libya into, you know, a failed state, essentially, they've had a little bit of trouble, right, actually getting that oil to the market. Iran's another one, and their ability to export.
So Libya is a failed state. Like, and still to this day.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Iran has its own host of issues diplomatically with the United States and other Western nations, and Iraq, what a hornet's nest that is. So.
Yeah, I would agree. Hornet's nest is a good way to describe it. Yeah. So, so the reason I started down this trail is because this was my perception of the system. So I was sharing memes, right, you know, right and left when the war broke out, and when it was rumored that the Saudis were going to stop accepting dollars for oil and they might start trading yuan instead, which they've done a little bit of. There have been a couple of contracts out there that were executed between the Chinese government and Saudi Arabia for oil. That's happened, not en masse or in large quantities. But I was one of those people who was sharing memes of, like, you know, I'll post a link to it or whatever, but it's like Woody from Toy Story is the US dollar, and the Saudis are Andy, right, from Toy Story, and Andy is throwing Woody away, and it's saying, I don't want to play with you anymore. So the Saudis are telling the US dollar, I don't want to play with you anymore. They're going to start trading you on for oil. So this is a thing.
So what's the major problem there, though? I mean, you can trade goods for goods or currency for product or whatever. So why is it bad? In other words.
Right. Yeah. Well, so if you believe that the only reason the US didn't go into a hyperinflation in the 1970s, or if your framework is that, which is what mine used to be, right?
Okay.
If your framework is that the only thing that's really holding this dollar system together, where everybody trades in dollars, I buy a pair of shoes from China, you know, ultimately that transaction is paid for in dollars, even across the ocean. If you believe that oil trading with OPEC is the only thing that's holding that together, and OPEC, you know, primarily Saudi Arabia, the people who sit on the biggest proven oil reserves in the world, and you see that they might start to take yuan, you know, the Chinese currency, for their oil instead of dollars, well, then that is going to appear to you as if, oh, the US is going to lose its key currency status.
Okay.
The rest of the world is no longer going to trade in dollars, not going to invest in our assets, those kinds of things.
Got it.
So if the petrodollar system is your framework, then you look at a development like Saudi taking yuan for some oil and you're like, oh God, this is the end of the world. You know, or not the end of the world, but the end of the dollar as we know it.
Dollar hegemony.
As we know it.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a perfect way to say it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's part of why, you know, I feel so strongly about this issue, is because that used to be my framework, you know, for months into the Russia-Ukraine thing, that was the way that I analyzed this issue. And I was thinking, oh yeah, you know, it's over. I was one of those, I was a dollar doomer, which is
because,
what I call that.
Because why? I mean, what did the war do?
So the war caused the G10, or maybe the G7 might be more accurate,
okay,
to sanction Russia,
right,
a major producer and exporter of oil. So to keep Russia from using dollars and euros, which are, you know, the dollar isn't the only key currency in the world. It's also, you know, the euro is also held around the world by central banks, and it's used for international transactions here and there. So the sanctions forced Russia out of that system.
Okay.
They essentially forced Russia to de-dollarize. And so the theory was, is, okay, you're now, the U.S. through its foreign policy is now forcing these other commodity rich countries in the world to pick a side. Are you going to be a dollar user country, or are you going to be over there with the, you know, with the Russians and the Chinese and whoever else decides to join that group? So that was the main concern, and that's the how.
So we're, you mentioned, I believe in the last episode that we did, that the Russians were, I think you said that the Russians were buying and or trading oil and whatever else in dollars with the United States, even under, excuse me, the Soviets were.
Yes. Yeah, they did.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They accepted, you know, the Soviet Union was an oil exporter as well as a wheat exporter. Uh-huh. So a lot of Europe's wheat is grown in Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union, and also in Russia. So they were exporting their commodities, and they were receiving dollars for those commodities, and they didn't see any trouble with it back then, even under the Soviet Union.
Okay.
Then they would park those dollars in British banks, sure, and
okay,
banks based in Paris. And then they would use those to import the things, you know, like steel and other materials for weaponry. And
so now, because they're trading in dollars, the dollar's used more, dollar has currency to be the global reserve currency, because even our mortal enemy, the Soviet Union at the time, was still trading essentially in dollars.
Absolutely.
So fast forward to what, 2014, 2020, whatever, however you want to bifurcate that, or the, mm-hmm, or wherever you say the start of that war invasion is, and they start sanctioning Russia, the current Russia, and then that creates a panic to some degree that Russia is now going, because of the sanctions, they're no longer going to trade with dollars, and they're going to use China as their main trading partner, and then thus utilizing the yuan, or whatever the name of the Chinese currency. Is that a fair analysis?
Sure. Yeah. And they've been selling their oil for Indian rupees, and they've been selling it for yuan. And I believe there's a couple other ones. The Emiratis, I think their currency is the dirham.
Yeah.
So they've done a little bit of business there. So what I would, a couple interesting developments there. So the Russians are now sitting on, I believe, the equivalent of about $140 billion of Indian rupees.
Okay.
Those Indian rupees are bank deposits in Indian banks that the Russians
they can't be expatriated, right?
They can't be expatriated because India has a closed capital market,
right?
Which is part of having a key currency. If you want to have a key currency, you have to have an open capital market.
Okay.
That was true of the British with the pound sterling back in the 19th century. It's been true of the US. If the US decided we're going to limit foreign direct investment, or we're going to make our country a roach motel, so once you get dollars in here, you can't pull them out, or you got to wait several months or whatever,
right,
that would undermine our key currency status more than anything else.
Okay.
So that's a big one. That's true for China to a certain extent. There are investors who can't pull their money out of China. The Russians, you know, a sovereign, or Gazprom, an entity that is, you know, the Russian main energy company that is backed by their government, can't get its own Indian rupee deposits out of India, and they can't convert them to anything else.
Okay.
And they can't use them because Indian rupees are only good for what India makes. And at the end of a year, Russia already has enough of what India makes.
Okay.
So it has this excess that it can't do anything with. Oh, there you go.
All right. So, and now Russia, due to the sanctions, they're not using U.S. dollars, or they're using less of them, or is this a total farce?
Yeah, so it's definitely less. They're using less dollars and euros significantly. As far as Russia's official foreign exchange reserves go, they haven't added to that stock in many years. I believe it's actually been since 2014, which is also true for China. So China hasn't been a net buyer of dollars, hasn't been a net buyer of U.S. bonds or anything like that since 2014. So when we talk about de-dollarization on the Russia-China front, they have effectively been de-dollarizing for 9 years now.
Okay.
And what I would ask for people who believe that Russia and China are going to determine the fate of the dollar, you know, eventually this has to show up in the price somewhere.
The price
The
price of what?
Right. Yes. Yeah, so the price of these currencies against each other.
Okay.
And the prices of these assets against each other.
Got it.
So, yeah. So by the time that the sterling, by the time the sterling system had really been eradicated from the earth, we're talking about basically 1950.
Okay.
Sterling had been devalued a couple of times. After World War One, the British desperately wanted to get sterling back to its old gold parity, which would make it equal to $4.86. The Fed had to help them get it there. They had to help them maintain that price, and in the process created a deflationary economic depression type environment in the UK just by trying to establish this monetary standard. Because the world did not any longer value £1 sterling as $4.86. So decades before the sterling really lost its status as the global key currency, it was already relevant in the price of that currency that it was not as valuable to the world anymore. Again, they had to work really, really hard to maintain that parity, because the rest of the world didn't simply was not agreeing that one sterling was equal to $4.86. Now, they floated against gold in the Great Depression, and the pound depreciated. And it depreciated during World War II, and England lost a significant amount of its gold, and the rest of Europe lost a significant amount of its gold. So these things show up somewhere. The point is these things show up somewhere long before the change actually happens.
So right? They lost it because they had to pay for things related to the wars. They had to pay for, you know, reconstruction or war materiel or whatever it might have been.
Absolutely.
And the U.S. was the main benefactor, really.
Yes, because we were making the stuff and shipping it. And in World War One, especially, we didn't have to fight the war until the very end, so we weren't negatively affected by it. We only got the increase in demand for our weapons and boats.
Right.
Right. 1914 to 1918, you know, those years, or I guess 1917 is when we got in. So we're just benefiting from their conflict at that point. So so I would just ask, you know, where are the currencies since Russia and China have de-dollarized since 2014? Where have the currencies gone since then? Where is the dollar against the ruble and against the yuan? And the fact of the matter is that the dollar has appreciated significantly against the ruble, and it's appreciated significantly against the yuan. The yuan is weaker than it was in 2014, and it's been basically a downward trend ever since.
And the euro too, right?
And the euro too. Yeah, so I remember when I went to Ireland in 2011, it took $1.25, something like that, to buy a euro. And now a euro is $1.06, $1.05.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's even, absolutely.
And before that, it was like $3 to buy a euro or something like that. I mean, it was up there. Yeah.
It was.
When I was in Ireland last, gosh, many years ago, this was in the late 90s, before they transitioned to euros, their currency was strong at that point against the British pound.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then they went on the euro standard, and the British, which created a whole host of other problems on the island because, you know, whatever. But you have euro and pound sterling, you know, in the north because it's part of the UK, and, you know, in the right. south, it's, you know, they're on the euro. But, I mean, the British trade, you know, I mean, you could probably, I don't know how it goes, but, you know, they're being part of the EU, they're tied somewhat, or formerly of the EU, they were tied pretty heavily to whatever the euro might have been, I would guess.
And their economic policy, there's certain things that, you know, they had to follow.
Sure.
Follow yeah. the leader
anyway,
on.
That's beside the point. But the thing is that when your economy is strong, you're producing things and selling things, your currency is going to be stronger against the other ones, typically.
Yes.
I guess this is maybe where we're going with this.
Yeah, and just so we don't give any wrong exchange rates here, so the euro is basically $1.09.
Okay.
$1.09. And the British pound is hovering right around the what I would call the 30-year average. So okay. after the several devaluations that happened between uh-huh. World War II and you know, call it 1980, is about $1.25.
Okay.
So which is, like I said, it's right around kind of a 3-decade average, but yeah. euro is definitely a lot lower. So if we could, I want to just review that evidence that was mentioned in
sure.
the Forbes article.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Because, okay, so an agreement that was made between, so there's two things here, like two claims. There's an agreement that's made where, you know, the Saudis are only going to accept dollars for their oil. Okay, so the problem is that never happened. Like there's literally, I've looked high and low, and this is kind of what converted me and forced me to take a different framework of how this system really works. It's like, mm-hmm. I looked high and low for that agreement. It doesn't exist, right? So there's, and then there's another claim, which is that the Saudis wanted to accept gold. They started asking for gold and demanding gold and for their oil and even other fiat currencies instead of dollars. Okay. 1971 to 1973, 1974, talking about the oil embargo. So gold window gone to oil embargo, that 2.5-3 years. That never happens either.
Okay.
Right. So it's not there. So the reason, though, to give everybody their, you know, to give petrodollar people or whatever their due, to give this theory its due, I think that this theory is the result of a game of telephone. So the phrase petrodollar enters the lexicon, as far as I can tell, in September 1973. And before that, it was called the oil money. So the context here is that you have in the world, I think we did this before, but mm-hmm. if you can kind of divide the world up into long oil countries yeah. and short oil countries, or broadly, you could say energy long and energy short. So you have a lot of energy short countries around the world, and the US is importing 35% of its oil at the time, and European countries are having to do a lot more. So you have oil energy short countries who are looking at the Gulf states.
Right.
And oil prices are increasing even before the embargo.
But the U.S. is short oil at this point. A short oil country or nation, whatever you want to call it.
Importing 35%. Yeah.
Yeah. But we could survive in the United States on our oil. It was just cheap. It was just easier and cheaper to get it at a cheaper source as opposed to from Texas or Alaska or wherever else. Right. I mean, that's really, this is a arbitrage, right?
More I would have to look into that. I know. So now,
so you don't have to deplete your
own
thought as a finite resource.
Stocks,
who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know if that's even true right now, but
yeah. Well, I think
peak
that
oil and
we
all that.
Knew about the shale basins back then.
Okay.
Cause fracking technology I read was developed actually back in the 50s,
okay.
and it just wasn't brought in and actually used until, you know, the 2010s.
Okay.
Right. So I think we knew about these proven reserves and just weren't tapping them. I would have to do a little bit more research though to give,
It was just, I think the cost of acquiring the oil, not necessarily the oil in the ground as a certain price, but the cost mm-hmm. of acquiring it and doing more putting more drills in the ground or wildcatting for oil or whatever. It's already there in the Middle East. It's already there, and it's gushing, essentially.
Yes.
So might as well just deal with that then.
Yep. And our refineries, too, are constructed such to refine a mix of oil from different sources around the world.
Okay.
So the U.S. hasn't built a new refinery since the mid-70s. Uh-huh. I think it was actually 1973. And the way that our refineries are set up, if we only had U.S. light sweet crude, that's what mostly comes out of the ground here. Mm-hmm. If we only had that, our refineries would actually struggle to make gasoline because they're constructed to take our light sweet crude, blend it with Middle Eastern crude, blend it with heavier oils from different parts of the world to make the derivatives that we need.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. So if we only used U.S. oil, that would actually be a snag in the supply chain for a while until they could kind of readjust the refineries to be able to do that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that part. That's makes it really interesting on why we're so dependent on foreign oil.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why a lot of people ask, why do we import any at all? Because we on paper, we produce more than we need in mm-hmm. the U.S. Mm-hmm. Every day we produce more than we need. And that's why. It's because of how the refineries are set.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So 1973, so oil short nations are looking, and the economists in those nations and the treasury departments in those nations, they're looking at the Gulf states, and they know that the Gulf states are raking in dollars hand over fist because oil prices actually start going up before, and in inflation in general starts going up before the oil embargo in 1973. Not very much, but you get from like in between 1971 and 1973, you probably get from like $2 to $3, in those years, which is not huge, but that's 30%.
Sure.
And then the embargo brings you to $11 a barrel, which is so almost three times over. And so these policymakers, I hate that term. It's actually right. They're criminals, but we call them policymakers in polite society, right? Yeah. So they start coming up with these ways of, okay, how are we going to get those petrodollars? That's when they start using the phrase. So late 1973, and before that, it's just referred to as the oil money. How do we take this oil money? So we know that the Gulf states are getting all these dollars. We're paying the dollars because we have to get the energy. How do we get them back out to the rest of the world? Hopefully in the form of investment. How do we get the Saudis to take these surpluses and funnel them back to, how do we make it so that this does something for us in the end? And that's what is now what you might now call petrodollar recycling. Mm-hmm. But that's the conversation that's going on as far as the, political and the geopolitical sphere around this time. It's how do you take the petrodollar? It's a given, by the way, that the money that the Saudis and the Gulf states are getting is dollars. They never threaten to demand gold. They never threaten, we want marks instead of dollars, whatever. Everybody knows that they're getting dollars. The question is, how do we get those back out?
Right.
So that's the context in which, and so you start to see this phrase used many, many times over during this period in which it's thought that these agreements are made, 1973, 1974. It's in the news a lot. And so that's why I think this is more of a game of telephone that's turned into this idea that, somewhere along the way, somebody added to the story, the Americans made this agreement where it determined what currency the oil would be bought and sold for. But that's not really what the concern was at the time. It was the Saudis are going to get all this money, and rather than having them sit on it, how do we get it back out to the world? So the IMF is trying to figure things out, a lending facility where the Saudis would contribute, and then the IMF would manage the money and lend it to developing countries because they were hit the worst by this.
Right.
A poor country that does not extract its own oil is going to be the worst hit by, a three times increase in the price of energy. Right. So that's what's going on at this time.
Okay.
And I think that's where this theory kind of got, where it kind of got started in the first place.
Yeah. So the game of telephone is essentially like, two things that I heard. It's they're saying, a lot of these folks are saying that there is a policy when there is not. It's just what the de facto policy is not the de jure policy. And the second would be whatever gets repeated. It's whatever gets repeated, not what gets reported. And what gets repeated is the petrodollar. Petrodollar. So it's in your head, as opposed to just the old conventional thing of saying it's just oil money or money that is that now the oil rich countries have. It's just their money. And now it's petrodollar, scare quotes.
Yeah. And the same thing, like if we replace oil with wheat and there's a global shortage of wheat in the early 1970s, we could have, and so the price of wheat skyrockets, you know, it multiplies four times over. And so the Soviet Union is raking in all of these dollars that are being spent on wheat. We could have just as easily ended up with the idea of a wheat dollar.
Sure.
Right. But that's not the commodity that was in question. Okay. During this time, it was oil. So we ended up saying and using this phrase petrodollar. But, you know, what's happening here is the Saudis are accepting the global currency. They're accepting the global key currency for the oil. And there's no interruption in that. We know from our conversation last time that when the agreements with what became Aramco and the Saudi monarchy were made back in the 30s, they demanded 4 shillings a barrel for, you know, their slice of the oil trade. So we know that they're kind of going along with whatever the currency is.
The petro shilling.
Petro shilling. Yeah, there you go. So we know that they're basically willing to use whatever the global key currency is at the time. In the 30s, it was the sterling. So that's what they wanted. Fast forward to the, you know, the post-World War II era, it's the dollar. So that's what they're taking.
So we got a few more minutes here today, and we'll pick this up again later, Jason. But what we have now is we have the petrodollar theory more or less debunked, or not entirely debunked, just it's a reimagining, reconfiguring of what actually is meant by petrodollar in real terms versus this imagined case. Now, you say like no petrodollar, but these foreign, or the Saudis in particular, are taking foreign, or the U.S. dollar. It's not backed by oil per se, as all these, a lot of economists or commentators might say. But your argument, and I think it's a valid one, I believe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's the dollar is backed by debt.
Yeah. So I think of this in terms of what is the reserve asset. So in banking arrangements,
that sounds strange to me.
Yeah,
that something is backed by a negative.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it agreed.
So explain that part for a little bit until we meet again, I should say.
Yeah. So, I would start with this. I had a couple examples, which maybe we could cover next time to give people like a more intuitive idea of how this works in the reserve asset. But let's just look at legally a couple of different arrangements in the modern era. So, you know, the modern capitalist era with banking and, you know, moreover fractional reserve banking. In 1844, the arrangement by which the Bank of England could print banknotes. Okay, so the Bank of England's banknotes at this time are the base money for everybody in the UK. So if you're transacting with cash, you're using Bank of England notes. When the banks settle with each other, they're using Bank of England notes or deposits at the Bank of England, which are promises to pay Bank of England notes. The Peel's Act, 1944, says that those notes have to be backed 100% by gold. So gold bullion sitting in the Bank of England. That's the backing for 100% of the Bank of England's notes, except for they could have $14 million, which was a lot more money back then than it is now, obviously. 14 million pounds sterling, excuse me, of other securities. So they could have $14 million worth of, you know, bonds or bills of exchange that they would buy off the banks, something like that, to back those notes. So, but it's mostly gold. Okay. Now, so that's one. Now, in that case, what is everybody in society transacting with? So you and I, two customers of two different banks in London. Okay, so I pay you £1,000 sterling.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that we go ahead and we use notes. You deposit those notes with your bank in London. Okay, so we just transacted using the liabilities of private banks. Now, on the other side of that, and this is the what's called the wholesale side of banking, but this is where the banks settle up with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when one of us pays the other, we add a liability to the bank, right, that gets those notes. So when I paid you with notes, you know, you took those notes and you put them in your bank, that bank now has an additional £1,000 sterling of deposits. That's a liability to them because at any given time they have to take notes and they have to pay them out to you should you demand them.
Yeah.
Right. So on the other side of that, so anytime a bank is paid by another customer, that bank is then going to go to the bank where it got that liability in the first place. And sorry, I kind of twist turned myself around because that would have been a lot more appropriate example with a bank deposit. But anyway, so the let's call it the retail layer of the system. We are paying each other with bank liabilities.
Okay.
And then you have the wholesale layer of the system where banks are then paying each other. So I pay you, you bank at Citi, I bank at USAA. If I Zelle you,
right,
$1,000, then Citi has an additional $1,000 where it may have to pay out cash or it may have to pay out in the form of a transfer at any time. So they go to USAA at the end of the day and they say, hey, I need $1,000 of assets to, to compensate this $1,000 of liabilities that I just got because your customer paid my customer.
Right.
So they're going to do that at the end of the, at the end of the day. This is just typical settlement and it's been happening in different ways for hundreds of years. So that base layer, 1844, pounds sterling, Bank of England, is gold. When the Fed gets introduced, 1913, up until, call it, up until 1971, really, up until the end of the, you know, what's called the Bretton Woods system, what people usually call that, the Fed is required to back 40% of its notes and reserves with gold. Right. So for every dollar of banknotes, of Federal Reserve notes and bank reserves at the Fed, they have to have 40 cents of gold.
Okay.
So that's the sense in which, you know, we, again, the retail layer, we transact in bank liabilities, and then the banks pay each other with their central bank's liabilities. So banks, just imagine back in the gold standard days, imagine that I pay you $1,000. Your bank then goes to my bank at the end of the day and demands $1,000 in reserves at the Fed or Federal Reserve notes. One of those two things. Usually just a paper deposit, a paper transfer would do just fine, you know, because they're doing this in the modern era. They're going to be doing this over the phone. Probably it's not necessarily going to be everybody piled into a room. In the old, old days, they would pile into a room and they would do this on paper. You know, there the New York Clearinghouse was a place where representatives of banks went and they settled up with each other at the end of each day.
Yeah.
You know, you had this many customers pay my bank. So now we have this many deposits. So now I need this many notes or I need a deposit of this amount in your bank or whatever. So they're settling up. Okay. So at the end of the day, the base money is in some way redeemable for something that's not a liability. Gold is what's called a non-counterparty risk asset. That means that when you have it, the value of that gold doesn't depend on somebody else's ability to pay. If you have somebody else's liability, right? If you have a bank deposit, that depends on the safety of the bank.
Right.
Right. So, so gold is a, or it's also called a bearer asset. So that just means that I have it and nobody else does, whatever. So ultimately,
yeah, you can go to Die Hard, the bearer bonds, you know, the bearer, the bearer bonds that they were breaking into the safe for. So that's why they were so valuable.
Yeah. Bonds, and that's where, I could, we could have a whole trivia conversation about bearer bonds. Cause it's interesting how they still affect how we talk about different things in finance.
Yeah.
Like the word coupon actually comes from the bearer bond because on every bearer bond, every cash flow, every interest payment on that bond had a piece of paper that you would rip off. It was perforated, mm-hmm. and you would take the piece of paper to, you know, where whatever bank, and you would say, hey, I am the one bearing the, you know, the coupon payment, please pay me notes or gold or whatever.
Right.
So interesting how all that works. But anyway, so now in what I would call the bastardized gold standard, we have a system where people cannot directly redeem their notes for gold. Right. So
there's just not enough of it.
Well, it's that, and it's also prohibited by law. So, 1933, FDR takes us off, you know, what I would call a retail gold standard. So people can no longer redeem the dollar for gold or even gold certificates. Uh-huh. You're done. All right. So, and all of the other countries at this point in the Western industrialized world have done the same thing. So now the only forces in the economy that can redeem each other's currency for gold are the central bank. Mm-hmm. So the only way that there's any gold redemption is if, you know, what happened in the late 60s, France has more dollars than it wants. It's got more dollar deposits than it wants. So it goes to the Fed and says, hey, you know, we're getting all these dollars because we're trying to maintain the peg. Now, please give us gold. All you have to do to make this connection of like, okay, now the dollar is essentially backed by debt is, what does anybody do now that there is no gold? Okay, a sovereign wealth fund that's based in China or a sovereign wealth fund that's based in Norway, they're going to have a lot of deposits of dollars. They want an asset that's a little bit safer than dollars. That's, you know, because we live in a world of currencies that tend to inflate, mm-hmm. right? So they want their hands on something that's a little bit safer than just deposits on paper. What do they do? What does the Central Bank of France do, or the Central Bank of Thailand, or the Central Bank of, you know, the Bank of England? What do those banks do when they want something considered safer than just a deposit of US dollars? Well, they go to the Fed and they buy US Treasury bonds and they buy mortgage-backed securities. And those are just debt instruments.
Mm.
So the only thing that they can trade for that liability, the only thing they can trade for those dollars is literally a promise to pay more dollars in the future, except with interest.
And right? They get their money theoretically, if it's a mortgage-backed security, through the mortgage payments that have been issued. Yep. And then the U.S. Treasury bonds, more or less, are financed by tax dollars, by American working class folks.
That's right. That's right. So these liabilities that we use to pay each other, it has more or less always been the case for the last several hundred years that you and I, right, the retail layer of the system, have used bank liabilities to pay each other, right? Mm-hmm. Like even in 1890, people would all the national banks, the private banks with national charters, they would print their own notes. Uh-huh. And then their customers would use those notes to pay. So somebody who banked at JP Morgan would use JP Morgan notes to pay a customer of Citi, right? So it's, and if they didn't use notes, then they would write a check. And if they didn't write a check, then they would just do direct deposit transfers. So you would actually walk up to the banker and you'd say, please transfer $100 to this account for my account, whatever. So it's been the case for a long time that at the retail layer, we transact in liabilities. That's mm-hmm. nothing new. What is new, in my view, what is new since 1971 is that nowhere in the system can anybody turn that liability into something that is not a liability. Right. So
yeah, you're not turning. I mean, getting back to the whole point, you're not turning it into oil. You can't just buy a barrel of oil with that. Like mm-hmm. you can't redeem it for oil. That would be a petrodollar.
Right. Yeah, that would truly be a petrodollar.
It's like you had a gold, you had a gold dollar. You could, historically, you could redeem it for literal physical gold. You cannot mm-hmm. redeem a dollar for a barrel or some amount of oil. You have to, you know, use the dollar to then buy, you know, and the dollar is then, like you said, financed by all these debt instruments. So it's financed by debt, but it's really the debt instruments that people still have confidence in mm-hmm. because you often hear that, oh, the only thing holding up the US dollar is confidence. It's like, well, that is mm-hmm. frightening. right? Number one.
Yes.
But when you say go one step further and you say, oh, no, it's backed by debt instruments that people mm-hmm. do have confidence in, like mm-hmm. because, well, except for 2008 and, you know, the growing, well, whatever. But the fact that you are going to probably get paid some amount with a mortgage-backed security and or a treasury mm-hmm. bond, that gives people a little hope as opposed to these other countries. Like if you have a treasury bond from, let's call it Ukraine right now or whatever, it's like, yeah, good luck. It's like the
right.
like having a continental dollar for crying out loud. It's like, okay, yes, what's that worth? Similar. Who knows?
Yep. Not very much.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. So anyway, all right. Well, let's leave it there. We got a lot more to talk about on this because I think I'm just getting started learning all this stuff. But, you know, going forward, I think we'll explore more of that Euro dollar market that you wanted to get to. But yeah, we can pick up this conversation anytime and, we'll have you back to do that. And anything you want to plug? Purcell Investments on YouTube. Is that right?
That's right. Still haven't got my Twitter account back up. So there will be a new Twitter account eventually here. I would like to plug just jpurcell.me if you want to get okay. in touch with me. You just fill out the form and or sign up for the list. And then the email address is contact@jpurcell.me. And then on Instagram, I'm @supply and demand update.
Okay.
So sometimes I post the different news things that I see that jump out at me and a little bit of analysis here and there.
Okay.
And
stuff like that, we'll put it all in the show notes too. So just make sure to read those show notes, guys. And all right, Jason, until next time, we'll chat with you down the line.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye. For more of our podcasts, head on over to briandeoleary.com. And while you're over there, sign up for our email list. We'll send you daily emails. You can also find the link for our Substack page and various other resource pages we have. And that's at briandeoleary.com.